You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm Marvin Smith, and it is a great pleasure to be your guest host today. Mr. Cardoza, Alan, is in the middle of producing another featured film and should be back in a couple of weeks. As for me, a brief background. I have 30 years in the helping fields. Former professional athlete turned advocate. My life is fighting in the trenches in public education, K-12, reform. Just a brief. And I have a master's and bachelor's degree in behavioral science. Each week, this show will bring you guests that will inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain you while bringing answers and options to raising children today in a constantly changing world. We will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and much, much more. It is our goal to bring you top professionals in many of the helping fields and authors sharing valuable stories and helpful information who are working to keep you, your family, mentally, physically, and spiritually sound, making this world a better place for all of us. And we will continue to bring you some of these incredible, talented, and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. What do an explosion, four house fires, fleeing from toxic chlorine gas, and escaping an attack by a knife-wielding assailant to our guest today? Each of these events are part of her early childhood and are graphically depicted in her new memoir, Joyride, Life, Death, and Forgiveness. Joining us today is Pamela Cofield, the director of a child advocacy program in Eastern Oregon, as well as a sought-after public speaker and author. Ms. Cofield, if I'm saying that right, but we'll see in a minute, is a child abuse survivor and the daughter of an ex-felon who spent much of her time advocating for abused children as a director of a CASA agency, which is court-appointed special advocate, and shares her personal experiences while speaking on the subject of abuse and recovery. Pamela, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Hi, Marvin. It's a real honor to be with you, and I will clear up the misunderstanding of my last name. It's spelled very oddly, so it's not your fault. The last name is Cofed.
Oh, Cofed. Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's K-O-E-F-O-E-D for your listeners, so you can see how Marvin messed up the pronunciation. Most people do.
Well, you know, Pam, like, I can say this. It's not the first thing I messed up, and I'm only human. I'm probably going to mess up a lot more. So I always say, welcome to the real world.
I was going to say something just like that. It's called being a human being, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But it's fascinating. You know, as I'm kind of reading through the excerpts of your book, Pamela, it's, first of all, this subject is really dear to me and my heart because of my background, a man of faith. An advocate in public education for K-12, working with communities and kids who can't help themselves. And so when you start to talk about abuse, a lot of stuff, it's all intertwined. So I think this is, we're going to have a good session today, and I'm really looking forward to asking you some questions and hearing from you.
Well, thank you. I am looking forward to the conversation as well.
Okay. Before we hear about your childhood, introduce us to CASA, which is a court-appointed special advocate for children.
Okay, CASA is a national organization. It was begun in the 70s by a judge in Seattle, Washington. He was very, very concerned about the cases concerning children that were coming before him. He didn't have sufficient information to make these radical decisions in their lives. And so he began by developing this program enlisting the help of community members as volunteers to be fact finders, to collect the kind of information that judges need to decide where a child should live with the parents in a foster home or in a relative or in some other situation. So that's kind of how CASA began. In CASA, we advocate for abused and neglected children, ensuring their rights and needs, ensuring that their rights and needs are met. We also encourage the children. So we're often the voice in the child's life. We may be the only positive role model they have, the only positive voice that they'll listen to, encouraging them toward a better life, giving them hope. The results and national statistics are showing that children who have a CASA pointed to them, now these are foster kids or kids that have been maltreated, abused, or neglected. Okay. The kids that have a CASA pointed to them, they are far more likely to succeed. They succeed. They have higher test scores in academics. They do better socially. They recover quicker. They often grow up to become successful adults. Just having one positive role model, one positive voice in a child's life makes a big difference.
Right. Well, for me, as you're sharing, it just reminds me of, you know, having that someone in your life that cares, or that voice that's positive, you know, because a lot of research, especially with a behavioral background, I understand that, you know, it shows all we need is someone positive in our life giving a voice, and we can become anybody and anything we want in this world. So I think you guys are doing some phenomenal work.
Thank you for that. Yeah, thank you, and I am so happy to hear that I'm talking with you today, because we share the same heart for kids.
Yes,
I love that connection that we have.
And I would have to say too, the host himself, Mr. Cardoza, I mean, we are really good friends, and he's another one that has a heart for youth and a lot of the work that he does. So I think we're at the end of the day, there are a bunch of us out in the world, and I just think it's time that we all start to pull these resources together, because it's a dying world. And if we don't, if not us, who? If not now, when? So we got to keep pushing. And sometime, just that encouragement, I just want to continue to encourage you. Keep up the fight. Keep up the good work. Now,
I appreciate that.
Maltreated children who have an advocate wouldn't fall through the cracks. And I imagine that they're far less likely to re-abuse while in foster care.
Oh, that's very correct. Because the CASAs consistently meet with the children, they get to know their child that they're appointed to. And when I say consistent, there are a lot of adults in foster kids' lives, but the children tend to look at the other adults in an adversarial way.
Yes.
They, even though social service and child welfare workers really have a heart for kids and are seeking the same goal we are, that the best interest of the child is met.
Yes.
Because the child welfare worker is the one who removed the children from the home, most children find it very difficult to trust the child welfare worker. They don't understand. They don't have the frontal cortex development to help them, enable them to reason it through and decide, this adult is well-meaning, this adult is helping me, this was necessary. Kids don't have that capability. And so what happens with the CASA is, because we're volunteers, we're not paid, all we care about is what happens to this child. In fact, this child, all the mama instincts in the women come out, and all the daddy instincts in the men that are volunteers come out, and we will fight for these kids. We will fight to see that their best interests are truly being represented in court. We'll go to battle for them on the school and with the school if we have to. For instance, if a child needs an IEP, which is a meeting concerning special education goals, then we will really push for that. If a child is lagging behind in an area and needs a tutor, we'll push for that. If something in the medical area is needed for the child, for instance, they haven't had their eyes examined in several years. DHS is, or the Department of Human Services, usually pretty fast to pick up on that, but sometimes they miss it. They're overwhelmed with the numbers of kids in care. We'll push for that. So we're there, but we're also the list listening to these children. They will open up to us. They'll share their horror stories with us. They'll share what it's like for them in foster care. The older kids especially will voice their frustration, and they can bounce things off of us. We're listening. We care. They know it. And so because of our interaction with the kids, when something comes up in their lives that needs the attention of a court, we are often the first one to speak up for these kids. We're the first one to notice it. On the other side of this, we monitor their placement. So if they're placed in a foster home or with a relative and things are starting to go haywire in their home where they're living, we're usually the first ones to pick up on it and bring that to the attention of child welfare. So kids who have CASA volunteers are much less likely to be re-abused while in care.
While in care. And that's good. I mean, and you said a word that resonated with me, overwhelmed. You know, when I think about care workers, when you think about people who are doing the good work, when I think about even ministry, people who are out in the trenches fighting the good fight, unfortunately, sometimes there are those who become overwhelmed, and it becomes hard for them to really focus why they're there. And then one bad instance, what do you say, one bad apple spoils a bunch, you know?
Right.
And so, but the majority of people that are in these programs, they're there for the support of kids. And that's, you know, even for myself being involved in public education on the reform side and looking at the need for charter schools. And for me, when you say advocacy, it's about what's best for the kids.
And exactly.
I think that becomes the area that I could see in your heart just in the pre-interview. I can feel it. You know, it's, like you say, in CASA, they're all volunteers. So you're fighting for what's right.
That's right, and sometimes the other adults that are also working toward the best interest of this child, sometimes they lose sight of the child.
Yes.
They get bogged down with the rules, you know, the law, and they lose sight of this child. That here is this very fragile, vulnerable child who's in the middle of a nightmare, has been traumatized, probably at home, traumatized again when he was removed from the home. He's vulnerable, he's afraid, he's angry, and they might lose sight of, here is this person that is basically, he's the wounded and he's the bleeding.
Yes.
And he needs emergency assistance. And sometimes they lose sight of that and they get wrapped up in the legal side of things, forgetting that this child's life is right now is just in the balance. And those kids, they need a lot of TLC.
Yes. Well,
and that love goes a long way to bring healing.
Well, as you said too, Pamela, I you know, it's important. And that care, that love, like you said, it goes a long ways. And there are some of us that get caught up, unfortunately, in the rules and regulations and forget about we're dealing with little human beings. And as you said earlier, that frontal cortex is not even developed in that little human being. And we have the opportunity to shape positive individuals and help these kids grow up to be productive citizens. But unfortunately, as we get caught up in this, and you'll be able to share more, if we're not careful, we end up, as a society, creating a bunch of kids who become horrible adults.
That's correct.
You know,
I heard a quote, and I'm not sure who to credit for this quote, but it's certainly true, and it speaks to what you're saying. Let's see if I can remember exactly.
Okay.
Building healthy children is easier than repairing broken adults.
Yes.
Doesn't that sum it up for us?
Yes, yes. Now, on that note, I mean, you have a personal, and I can hear it now, you have a personal experience with child maltreatment.
Mm-hmm.
Could you please share your story with us?
I would be glad to, I'm going to cut to the chase in my story,
okay.
But I really do encourage listeners to pick up Joyride, in which they can read the whole account, and I believe it would be very helpful. If they work with children, it'll be very helpful showing them what life is like, you know, life through the eyes of a maltreated child. I want to begin
Hold that real quick. Hold that thought. If you don't mind, I'm going to throw a plug in right here. Stepping up to understand and end child abuse, joyride, life, death, and forgiveness. And as Pamela was just sharing, if you really want to get to the heart and you really want to feel something that's heart-wrenching and really give you practical ways of overcoming, this is the book. Pick it up today. Go ahead, Pamela.
Thank you, Marvin. Thank you. That
I just
was
felt
awesome.
Compelled right there. Forgive me.
And I hope your listeners will do that. It blesses me. And every time somebody picks up a copy of Joyride, it fills me with hope. And it's like, well, this is the reason why I went through the childhood that I went through. This is why I suffered. This is why I'm alive. And it really, really encourages me because I know that nobody can read Joyride without having their hearts impacted. And that's very, very important to me. So my own story, oh my gosh, it's amazing. It's really even hard for me to really wrap my head around. my mother, by the way, gave me permission to share our story.
Okay.
And I am really grateful for a mom who was willing to be vulnerable, just as I am willing to be vulnerable.
Yes.
I was not the victim of physical or sexual abuse, for which I am most grateful. I was the victim of extreme neglect. I was placed in the threat of harm on numerous occasions, and I was eventually abandoned by my mom. So I want to just put it out there for your listeners.
So let me tie this together. An explosion.
Okay.
Four house fires. Fleeing from toxic chlorine gas. A wailing knife attack. Wow. I'm talking to you, but sometimes rationally you try to put these things together, and I'm going, it doesn't sound like the person I'm talking to. So, because sometimes as listeners, we can hear someone but really never understand where they've been. Mm. And I think the book helps depict that as well as we're hearing from you now. So, go ahead, Pamela.
Yeah, no, it sounds like it is from the movies, doesn't it? And, you know, it actually, I'm so I have recovered so much that sometimes it feels unreal. It feels like it was somebody else's story that I'm now, you know, having the opportunity to share, but it was really part of my life and my sister's life. And so I just want to begin my story by saying that, you know, not every parent comes with intuitive parenting skills, and some parents appear to have little nurturing instincts, and that shocks a lot of us because I know, and if you have children, you know, that the moment your newborn was in your arms, you were like crazy in love with that child, and there was no way you would ever let anything bad happen to that child. You know, and forget about exposing that child to anything that would be harmful. You would not do that. But unfortunately, there are parents that are born without these skills and without this nurturing instinct. And my mother was one of those. Fortunately, few parents are born without those ingredients that help them to parent well.
Right.
But there are some parents who just do not have that. And I hope this helps some of your listeners who've been traumatized by a parent. And just as you hear my story, I hope and I pray that it will bring healing and peace to them.
Yes.
So my mother, when she was in high school, she met my dad. They were both seniors in high school. After graduation, they married. That same year, they had my sister Robin. My sister Robin became like a second mom to me. I was born 22 months later.
Mm.
So my mom and dad were 22 years old, and they had two children.
They were kids.
Two babies.
They were basically kids.
They were kids. And prefrontal cortex, the front area of the brain, is not fully developed until people are usually into their 20s. I think they're saying like around 23 or 24.
Well, for the male, it's 25.
25,
yes.
Okay. That's the decision-making, rational side of the brain. And so what happens with our young people, they're more emotionally controlled than they are rationally controlled, and that's why they make stupid decisions, you know? Some of the crazy things they do.
So Pamela, so what you're saying there, that's why I was making all those stupid mistakes when I was younger, huh?
That it has a lot to do with that. That's for sure, and me too. You know, I made my own share of mistakes and mess ups, but somehow we all survive. I don't know how, but we do. So my mother and dad were very young when we were just infants.
Okay.
Soon after I was born, I think I was days old, maybe weeks old, my mother asked my dad for a divorce. Now, my dad was hardworking. He worked 9 to 5. He was dependable. He was stable. He was level-headed. His way of showing love was go to work every day, come back home, provide for the family. My mother was immature, impulsive. She wanted parties and dancing and travel. And from her own testimony, she grew bored with the marriage. And I think she grew bored with parenting and broke it off with my dad, divorced my dad. Broken people are broken because somebody has broken them, right?
Yes.
And so that's exactly what happened with my mother. My mother was broken. So not only did she have this impulsivity, she was immature, she wanted parties, she wanted a good time, she was bored with marriage and with parenting, but she was also broken. Both of her parents had horrendous addictions to alcohol. Mm. She said that her mother became cruel, and I know that when my Nana had too much Ripple, she became another person,
another
person, another personality. And my mother's dad, my Poppy, was the opposite. He was very nice. And the more he drank, the more he smiled, the more he laughed, and that's when he would begin speaking in an Irish brogue, although he'd never been to Ireland. So I always was amused by my grandfather. When my mother turned 18, my grandfather, Poppy, gave her a six-pack of beer. This says that it was expected and normal for children, for 18-year-olds to drink. It was expected, for instance, my mother expected that my sister and I would follow in her footsteps and drink with her, and she looked forward to that, which I'm grateful we never have. And so this is the environment in which I grew up. Her dad, my mother's dad, my Poppy, once owned a bar in Sacramento County. Now, this is where the story takes place. This is where I was born and raised. Mother said that she began taking Robin and I to the bar when we were infants. My mother said that with a lot of pride. She was very proud of that fact. By the time I was 7 and Robin was 8 and a half, during the summertime, Mother would take us to the Green Parrot. As soon as the door would open, sometimes we would pull up in front of the door and wait for the owner to arrive, unlock the door, and let us in. By this time, it had changed ownership. Someone else owned it besides my grandfather. And so we would go in the bar and sit at a picnic table across from my mother, where she was perched between her two drinking buddies at the bar drinking beer. And we would be there all day long, and sometimes late into the night, we would be there until my mother called for us to follow her. We would go out, climb into her 1967 Red Impala for a very frightening ride home.
Wow.
And she had a second bar that she liked to go to, and it was called The Vagabond, and it had a sign posted on it that said, "No minors allowed." Mother told me, and I was too young to understand what a miner was, so I thought they were gold diggers. I remember thinking, why can't gold diggers go inside there? What does that have to do with anything, and why can't we go inside? But Mother said it's illegal to go inside.
Wow.
But sometimes she snuck us past that no miner sign and snuck us past the drinkers that were lined up at the bar and snuck us into the women's restroom. And my sister and I would wait in that bathroom for hours for our mother. But most of the time when we went to the Vagabond, which was rather frequently, we waited outside in the car. Now, summer in Sacramento is really hot.
Very hot.
Really, really, really hot.
Yes.
And we would be in the car so hot. The windows were down, of course, and we'd sit up on the windows with our head outside breathing some fresh air. Mm. In the winters, we would shiver. It would be so cold. But we would wait out in that car until late at night, and again, for a very frightening ride home. And this is, like I said earlier, this is the childhood that I was born into.
And the thing about it, Pamela, as I'm listening to you, and it's touching my heart. I mean, we're only scratching the surface because I have fond memories of as a child, and we all do, whether they're good or bad. And those memories, I mean, they stick with you for a lifetime. And they basically are going to shape your future. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for you to even be here at this point and writing books, I mean, this is continue to keep sharing because it's getting interesting. Wow.
Yeah, the people ask. I think the number one question of me, and I speak to groups. I've been sharing my testimony with different organizations and church groups,
okay.
As well as on the radio. I think this is probably my 9th radio interview.
Okay.
And it seems like the number one question that people have in their hearts is, how did you recover? And I think that after I share some more of my story, then I can
yes.
share about recovery because it will mean more once I share
yes.
a little more.
Well, I got a few more questions before we get there because it's kind of like the punch, you know? You know, in your book, you mentioned that your mother's addiction worsened and her behavior became more bizarre.
Right.
You know, in your memoir, you know, readers are shocked by the event that led to her going to prison.
Right.
When you were 8 years old, she was in prison for crimes she committed, which placed everyone in the household in grave danger. It's amazing that no one was injured.
Right. And you know, again, broken people are broken because somebody broke them.
Yes.
My mother had a lot of resentments in her heart. She had resentments towards her mother for the childhood that she felt was deprived of her.
Okay.
You know, she had resentments probably from her first marriage, although she told me my dad was a very good man, and I know that he is. She remarried when I was probably five, because I think I was just entering kindergarten or around that time. She remarried another good man, another hardworking
man. Okay.
They began to have marital strife, and it became physical. So I witnessed, I witnessed the abuse between my mother and my stepdad, and that's when her drinking worsened.
Okay.
It spiraled downwards, and over a period of 1.5 years, she began committing crimes. Later, she would be charged as a felon and imprisoned in the California Correctional Institution.
Okay.
But her crimes put all of us in grave danger, and I don't want to do a spoiler.
I don't want to tell listeners exactly
what happened because that is just it'll ruin it for them. They'll be in suspense until they get to that part in the story.
Well, let me ask you this then. Aside from that, well, then what was life? And you tell me if this ties back. But what was life after her release? Was it was it better?
Oh my gosh.
She had
can you imagine the state returning children to a parent with behaviors like my own?
You mean she wasn't rehabilitated? You mean she wasn't, you know, spending time away? She didn't come back this pristine, perfect mother?
No.
Oh, really?
No, she didn't. No, she didn't. No, when she came home, she still had that stinking addiction. She still had that monster in her closet.
So it was never
she
dealt
still
with,
had all
what you're
that
saying.
Pain, all the bitterness,
mm-hmm.
and we were returned to her.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, this was years ago. I'm not going to say how many. Well, it was in the 70s.
Okay,
So I have 3 grown children. I'm over the age of 40. That's all I'm going to say. Anyways, we were returned to her care, and that same year that she was released from prison, she had my baby brother. Oh, my gosh, what an adorable baby. He had these darling little curls and this porcelain smooth skin. And I loved my brother the moment I saw him. And when he was 6 weeks old, she decided that Robin and I were grown up enough to babysit for her. Now, I was 9, and Robin was 10.5 years old. We didn't know how to take care of ourselves, but she left this baby with us for several hours or for a few hours at first. And then once mother saw that we could change the baby's diaper and give him a bottle while she was away, when she would go on her Friday night date, she would not come home until Saturday, maybe Saturday afternoon.
Really?
Then that escalated. She would leave on a Friday and not come home until Monday. So, of course, she would keep us out of school to babysit. So here we are, two little girls not knowing how to care for ourselves, and we were left with the responsibility of a newborn for 3 or 4 days at a time.
Now, what was your age again at this point?
I was 9.
Wow, okay.
And Robin was 10.5. And I was, because of the emotional losses in my own life, I was emotionally younger than a 9-year-old. And this happens with children who have had experiences such as I had. By this point, I'd already had a lot of trauma. A lot of trauma. I mean, the kind of traumas you see in the movies, you know. And again, I wasn't physically or sexually abused. It was a crime that my mother committed that caused me to flee from my life on 3 different occasions. And so emotionally, I was stunted. Children that are abused or neglected or survive traumas like I did, they are emotionally stunted until healing begins. And then they catch up. They catch up to their appropriate emotional maturity level. So, and my sister was also emotionally stunted. So we were given the care of this newborn.
Okay, now let me. That's very critical what you just shared.
Mm-hmm.
It catches up with you in development if there's some intervention.
Correct.
Okay, I just want, because it just doesn't catch up with you. You know, through osmosis, it something has to happen for that maturity, as you were just sharing, for it to catch up and to be that normalized person. And let me share a couple things and tie into this. You know, in a bulletin, Emerging Practices in Child Abuse and Neglect, released by the U.S. Department of Human Services, it states that there are risk factors that can be predisposed a parent to becoming neglectful or abusive. Your mother was young, a single parent, a heavy drinker. Both of her parents were addicted to alcohol. It appears that she didn't have the healthy adults consistently in her life. These are signs that she was at risk of abusing you and your sister, certainly, and neglecting your brother, as you're sharing. Would you say that's correct?
Oh, that's correct. That's correct. And as you pointed out in the bulletin, there are several risk factors of which my mother had most of those.
Okay.
And addiction is the number one risk factor. And the next one would be a lack of the support of an extended family, not having available adults to help with parenting creates a stress, especially on single parents. The other contributing factors are stress, such as joblessness, housing problems, and marital strife, chronic poor health, emotional illness mental illness or emotional instability, and victims of physical and sexual abuse. I believe the statistic is approximately 30% more likely to re-abuse.
Right.
Any of these can leave parents vulnerable to do things that they wouldn't normally do. I mean, no parent, you know, when they have a baby in their arms are thinking, well, someday I'm going to batter you, or someday I think I'll leave you for a week without any food, like my mother did with my sister and I.
Right.
You know, parents don't premeditate these things usually. Probably 99.5% of the time, there's no premeditation or forethought. It's just what happens when they become vulnerable. In 2012, some 700,000 confirmed cases of child maltreatment occurred in the United States. That same year, there were 3 million reports of children being maltreated involving 6 million children. I call this an epidemic of abuse in our nation. It's the worst social injustice imaginable. It affects our whole society on many levels. Intervention before parents blow a fuse or plunge plunge into problems, intervention is really the key. And the way that we can help, because there are some things we can help if I can share those.
Yes, and I'm going to add to that as well. I mean, as you're sharing, which is, very informative, I'm listening to you, and I go, and I look at the work that I do in public education and advocating for the same kids that you're talking about are kids that I'm trying to make sure they get a quality education.
Excellent.
And what happened, there's no one, little people can't defend themselves. They can't, so what do? They hold all this in, and then they become, as research shows, that abused and neglected children are more likely to neglect or abuse their children. Children of alcoholics are 4 times more likely than children to misuse alcohol. Children of incarcerated parents are 5 times more likely than other children to commit crimes leading to their involvement in the criminal justice system. But there is hope. And you are a living witness, a testimony of that hope. And that's why I believe, those who are out there, those listeners, you need to go get the book, because there are practical, there's insight. Because I don't care who we are, who you are, we all are dealing with some form of neglect, addictions in our family. Even if it's not our immediate family, we may have a brother or sister. It's not far from us, because the numbers that you just shared, Pamela, this is an epidemic. And it's one of the, I call it a silent epidemic. And it needs to be, and I see you as a voice.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And if I may, I just want to give your listeners some practical tools, because it fits so well with the risk factors.
Okay.
This is an entirely preventable and treatable malady. It isn't like some disease that we can't prevent. It's entirely preventable. And it's preventable through intervention, through adults, caring about other adults. Mm-hmm. Instead of being apathetic and turning our eyes away from what we think are people who are dysfunctional and a mess, it's actually making an effort to reach out to them. Now, I'm not saying that we all need to go, to our neighbor, the meth lab person next door or down the street, and knock on the door and say, here's a bag of groceries. I'm not saying that. But when we know adults, when we know parents who have any of those risk vulnerable indicators, then we can reach out to them in some form of support. And I'm sure it varies depending on what's needed. It may be groceries. It may be free childcare. It may be a listening ear. It may be a healthy sign of affection. I mean, maybe that adult needs a hug, from a dad figure. A lot of men that abuse didn't have a dad in their life. So come on, dads, rise up to the occasion here. Be a dad to a young man out there who is struggling. He's a single parent. He's had a history of addiction. He's struggling. What he really wants and needs is a dad. His heart is crying out for a dad. So I'm calling on all the dads that are listening, reach your arms around those younger men and show them the love that they didn't have. It will go a long ways. It will benefit that young man. It'll benefit his children. It'll benefit the children's children, because it'll break the cycle. It'll bring the change and the healing into that man that's needed for him to be able to go forward and be a healthy individual. So we can reach out to people. We can provide transportation. We can provide transportation to AA meetings. We can encourage these individuals to reach out to spiritual care, such as pastors or others in the Christian community, to receive that kind of spiritual care that they are in need of. We can encourage parents to reach out to social services. This takes a lot of courage, because there's a fear there that they're going to take my kids from me. But the time to reach out is before the abuse. And you just say a simple thing. You say, I'm vulnerable right now. Are there services available to me? Can you plug me into counseling. Some counties in our nation provide supports like this for parents and preventative services. Yes. So I just encourage the parents that feel like they're at risk of abusing or neglecting their kids to reach out and get help. And I encourage the adults who know other parents who are vulnerable to reach out to those individuals, and we will make a difference.
Well, it will really help, Pam.
I
think you said something as I'm listening, because I listen and I talk with a lot of people, and but I'm always, the way I'm wired, there's always these key points that jump out of my head. And you said something I think was paramount. Reaching out before. Because she, you ever notice when something tragic happens and it's part of like human behavior, you always hear, you know, I knew something wasn't right, but I should have, it's too late. You know, and I think what you're saying is, let's be proactive and let's do it before something happens and moving forward.
That's correct. That's correct. That preventing something from happening, reaching out before it happens, makes a lot more sense than trying to clean up a mess afterwards.
Intervention versus prevention. There's so much more. And when you look at the statistics and research, if we put more emphasis on prevention, you know, a lot of recidivism and the things we deal with on the intervention side, it wouldn't be there. But unfortunately, we seem to always do it backwards. And so I once again believe what I see in your memoir is actually speaking to these areas, and hopefully, you know, for me, encouraging individuals to step up. Come on. I mean, we got to be responsible. And I that's why I keep referring back to you. I commend you. I want to continue to keep and say encourage you, and because you're encouraging others, and keep up the good work. So go ahead. What I like to do, because looking at the time, probably another 10 minutes, and then at the end of the show, we have some listeners. I have some call-in questions that I would love for you to be able to give some input to.
Oh, boy, okay. That's exciting. I would love to talk with some of your listeners. And so I, just in my childhood story, I'll finish up by saying my mother's neglect escalated. And I remember she was leaving my sister and I when we were little kids alone with my brother.
Yes.
And baby brother. And it went from taking care of my baby brother for 2 or 3 days to a week, and then 2 weeks. Mother would vanish. She would say, I'm going to my boyfriend's. Here's the number where I can reach. This was before cell phones. And then she would vanish. We would run out of food. We would run out of food. We'd run out of diapers. What do you do with a newborn when you don't have any diapers? And by this time, Stephen was probably 6 months old, so he's no longer a newborn. And we're out of diapers, and so we used towels. And towels don't absorb very well. We ran out of towels. Yes. What did we do? I don't even remember. I just remember the sores on my brother's body, that his bottom was covered in a hideous diaper rash with oozing sores. And how much fear I had. I was so fearful. My mother had told me that about a family of children that was removed from their mother because of abuse. And I think she instilled that in my sister and I to keep us quiet. Well, it really worked, because the last thing we wanted was to be split up into different homes.
Right.
And so here we were, these little kids who were out of food. Hunger, being hungry, became the new normal. In the summer months and in the fall, there's fruit in neighborhood trees.
Right.
In Sacramento County.
Yes, yes,
and
okay.
So we would leave our apartment. And of course, we didn't leave the baby alone, but we would leave the apartment with a brown paper bag, and we'd go through the neighborhood looking for fruit. And usually it was plums. And, you know, I learned that you can survive on plums. I also tried panhandling. I tried it one time. I was successful, but it wasn't agreeable to my sister, and it was really scary. So I only did it the one time. I also dove into dumpsters looking for useful things. Because my mother never cared for us, my long brown hair natted up to my scalp. I looked like I had dreadlocks. My clothing was never washed. I was completely neglected on every level. And this went on until I was just about 12 years old.
Now, I have a question. Now, what you just shared, I'm thinking now, where are the adults in the environment? Where are the grown folks watching these kids care for this baby around the neighborhood? I'm like, were there any other adults around?
Oh, sure there were. And these are questions that only God really knows the answer to. I don't know what the adults thought when they saw me in dirty clothes. I wet my bed, which is a sign of distress in young children. I couldn't control it. I mean, I just wake up and I would be all wet. My underclothes were never washed. My clothes were never washed.
Yes.
So there had to be an odor. My condition, my physical appearance was very pathetic. So that's a good question. I do know that I had a great aunt who was reaching out and trying to intervene, but my mother made up stories. I believe we were hid in the bathroom at the Vagabond because my aunt had gotten the word that my mother's daughters or my sister and I were sitting out in the parking lot in a car in the hot summer heat. And so she took us in the bathroom to conceal us probably from this aunt. My dad tried to intervene in his own ways, but nobody knew the severity of our problem. Even though we had all these outward appearances, mother had all the risk factors, I don't know that the people that were emotionally stable in my immediate family, I don't know if they really figured it out or put it together. I think it was also sometimes we choose to believe what we want to believe, and I think that thinking about what might be happening to Pam and Robin, I think that was a heartbreaking thing to do. So those adults may have avoided thinking about it too much, but we were silent.
Yes.
We did not tell. We protected our mother.
Yes.
By doing so, we felt like we were protecting the family unit. We were I in particular was very attached to my mother, and so the last thing I wanted was to leave her.
Right.
And that's very typical in children. And so there was all this going on, you know, and we were silent. My dad did eventually ask us some questions that brought out some of the things that were happening in our lives, but we concealed most of the tragedy.
Wow. And there's a word I'm going to use that, especially as a young child, that it becomes part of the process, and it's going to lead me into my next question, is fear.
Mm-hmm.
There's it becomes this unhealthy limit of fear that almost becomes transimposed to what's good is bad and what's bad is good.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's correct. And, you know, because of the traumas, fear, really had a hold on me, and I'm so glad that I've been completely, as far as I know, completely healed of post-traumatic stress disorder,
yes,
which I used to have, and some other issues related to the traumas,
okay,
and of course the fear of abandonment and rejection.
Yes.
For people that have been abandoned or rejected or neglected or abused, the rejection issues can pop up from time to time,
yes,
even in recovery, even in the healing process. I think it's a journey, and it's just something that we have to work through. You
yes
know, we all have our challenges. For me, one of my challenges working through the rejection issues, when somebody makes a decision that doesn't include me, it wasn't, I realize now it's not personal, and I
right
remind myself it's not personal. It's about them. It
right
has nothing to do with me.
But
it's not, in other words, it's not a rejection, and it wasn't intended that way.
Right.
But people that have been abused tend to feel rejected,
yes,
when certain things happen, even if that isn't reality. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And so the same with fear. Fear can present itself in many different ways, and it can influence and affect us. It can keep us from enjoying life. It can prevent us from going from forward movement, or it can cause us to do irrational things. And so these kinds of issues really, really need to be looked at and resolved and healed so that the individual can enjoy this life that we've been given.
Right. Now, for sake of time, because we're winding down here, one question, I want to make it brief, because this is really great for the listeners to pick up your book. And then I have a few questions here that would, because for the sake of time, is it okay? Along with your inspiring, message of hope, forgiveness is part of your message that you're sharing with the audience, with audiences across the United States. In your memoir, you describe the heart-touching account of forgiveness that you offer to your mother and how it impacted her. Forgiveness is essential for recovery. All that being said, the person that I'm talking to today on this radio station, very coherent, very salient, then what I hear, at the end of the day, it comes down to forgiveness. And
it does.
And if you could just touch on that real brief, then we want to get to these questions. And I could go on and on and on, but we don't have that kind of time. And it's been a pleasure as well, Pam, but go ahead.
Thank you, Marvin. Yeah, forgiveness is essential for healing and wholeness. And all of us have had times in our lives when we've been hurt or offended, or somebody we love has been hurt, and we have then taken on bitterness, or we've held a grudge, or we've had anger or resentments. Those kinds of emotions do us more harm than we realize. Neuroscience has research, and there's just not time to go into it.
Yes.
But in my next book that I'm working on, I go into much more detail about these principles. But neuroscience shows that strong memories, and since we're talking about abuse, we'll say the memory of abuse is a very, very strong memory. With magnification, neuroscientists were able to see that the memory actually looks like a tree with branches.
Yes.
And the more we think about, rehearse, or meditate on, or experience feelings of anger or self-pity or hatred or grudges, what's happening is we're actually strengthening the negative toxic memory, and it's producing bad fruit in our lives.
Those neural networks become even that much more fortified and strengthened. And I'm real familiar with the whole area of neuroscience, like I say, with the behavior
background. Oh, awesome. Exactly what happens.
And one of the things... go ahead, Pamela. Go ahead.
And so what happens with these, this is one of the things that I teach in our local community in a class that I held for about 3 months. One of the things that happens is that... Those branches in that well-developed negative memory, the memory of the pain, the memory of the trauma, it releases emotions, and we may not even be aware why we're feeling the way we are. Why do we react to people the way we do? Why do we make poor choices that we make? It's because of the memory tree, because of the negative toxic memory.
Yes.
Neuroscience also has given us hope, and we have hope in the scripture also. The scriptures say that we should renew our minds. In fact, some of the principles that are shared, if you can find a scripture that correlates with it in the Bible, which is really, really remarkable, given that the Bible is so many thousands of years old.
Yes.
And so these neuroscientists say that we can actually be changed. We can change our behaviors and the way we feel by giving our memory, our good memories, positive feedback, and basically starving the negative memory. So we're not going to feed it. We're not going to participate with bitterness. We're not going to hold a grudge. We're not going to look back and keep reflecting and thinking about the awful thing that Uncle Joe did or that a parent did. We're going to let it go. And so forgiveness is a major key to that. When a person forgives, what they're doing is they're unlocking the prison doors that keep them hostage from healing and keeps that pain hostage. Unforgiveness keeps the memory hostage. It holds it hostage. The memories cannot be healed until that person takes and makes that step of forgiveness. And so that doesn't mean that what my mom did was right. It doesn't make it okay.
Okay.
In fact, it doesn't justify it. It doesn't even mean that she's not responsible for her actions. She is.
Right.
What it means is I'm now free. I am choosing by an act of my will to let go of bitterness, self-pity, and the pain. I forgive her, and then that way I can be healed and whole, and I can move forward. When we don't forgive, we are the constant victims of an abuse that might have happened 20 or 30 years ago.
And
do you understand?
Yeah, got it. And you know what? For sake of time, we are out of time. And like I said, we could go on and on. Didn't get a chance to get to those listener questions because it was such great information. But what we'd like to do real quick, if someone wants to buy the book, or if they want a phone number, if you could give that out real quick. And thank you very much for your time on this show for Answers for the Family.
Oh, thank you, Marvin. Oh, I'm sorry we're out of time. I was wanting to talk to your listeners. The book can be picked up at any local bookstore. Just request it. They can order it in. You can also get the book from me at joyridebook.com or call me at 541-417-1333. And it has been such a pleasure to visit with you today.
Same here, Pam. Have a good day, and I'm looking forward to fully going through the book. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Marvin.
Thank you.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.